From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, why some restaurants aren't waiting for new restrictions on indoor dining.
This is something that we were talking about before the governor announced the voluntary closure, which was just considering that a mandatory one would be coming potentially.
Also, we catch up with the package of election bills in play for Michigan and what business leaders have to say about them.
They kept it pretty vague here. But it's notable that they spoke out at all at this early stage.
And the return of Brood 10. My personal favorite bug, the periodic cicada, returns from out of the ground by the billion this spring.
And they're really large, noisy, lusty insects. And it'll be a spectacle this summer for sure.
Do tell! Those stories and more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. After weeks of setbacks, Governor Whitmer and the state's top doc are trying to reassure Michiganders about COVID vaccinations and public health rules. The message? You know what to do, so let's do it.
We still have the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. We've got more than 5.4 million doses in arms, and we will continue to aggressively move forward with our vaccination efforts.
All that's coming up later in today's show, but first, while the governor has not tightened restrictions on gatherings or numbers of people in businesses, we have been hearing some reports of restaurateurs in Michigan voluntarily stopping indoor dining amid this third surge of COVID infections. One such restaurant, Slow's Barbecue in Corktown, Detroit. Joining us to tell us more about that decision is Phil Cooley, the founder and owner of Slow's. Phil, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
How did you know it was time to put indoor dining on pause again?
We followed the numbers pretty religiously throughout this whole process, and we obviously have all seen the scary things happening in Michigan right now with the spike, and so this is something that we were talking about before the governor announced the voluntary closure, which was just considering that, you know, a mandatory one would be coming potentially. So we weren't caught off guard by any means. And it's, you know, something we ultimately made for ourselves based on our current situation.
Yeah. At the same time, you're very matter of fact about this, but I've got to believe as the person who's the owner of the business, like this has to, was this a hard decision for you to make?
Yeah, it's, you know, this is one of many difficult decisions we've had to make throughout, you know, the pandemic. Obviously, you know, we do great on the weekends, especially now during the pandemic, the disparity between the weekends and weekdays are considerable. And, you know, we'd love the extra money. We need it badly, and our employees need it as well. But, you know, the reality is these are unprecedented times. And, you know, whether it's the scientists that are doing the best that they can, or the economists are doing the best that they can, or just the local entrepreneur doing the best that they can to try to predict and understand and make the right decisions. You know, we're all flying a little blind, and throughout this whole process, we've erred on the you know, the side of caution because it's our employees' health, it's our customers' health, and it's our health. And right or wrong, that's the decision we've been making. And we hope that, you know, this is something we can get through the sooner the better, and this is the way that we personally feel we can do that. So we're, you know, reluctantly making this decision, obviously, but and not judging others that haven't. It's just that we're lucky that we have, obviously, outdoor dining, and carry out.
Yeah. You know, we have talked to some different restaurants that serve very different kinds of food. Obviously, it's been really tough for white table restaurants to go without in-person dining. How has business been for you? Is the barbecue crowd willing to do some carry out?
Yes. We've been fortunate, you know, before the pandemic, 10 years ago, we built a carry out location for commissary, carry out, and catering. So we're, you know, that location is set up for it. Grand Rapids has done, you know, okay. You know, when I'm trying to be positive, of course, this has been terrible for business for everyone, but, you know, a little bit better than if it were just just dining because we were set up for carryout ahead of time. You know, catering has been brutal, obviously, but carryout has certainly been the star for us throughout this whole process, and we've adapted too. We've done things like you order ahead of time in your neighborhood. You get your local neighborhood, you know, your friends to place an order as well. And if we get it like 10 carryout orders that we can bundle, the person who organizes gets theirs for free. So we've had great success doing these kind of bundled packages where we'll actually travel to communities. So it's like, you know, just like everybody, we've just tried to adapt as much as possible to fit into these new times.
That's really smart. As folks no doubt are able to hear, you're a family man, Phil. I know you've got young kids at home. What, if anything, does balance look like for a restaurant owner who has to be on location a lot, but also, you know, young kids who need you at home, too?
Well, you know, I'm lucky to have great partners. And, you know, folks definitely have that 3,000-yard stare. You know, they're the to say it's zombie-esque, it's an understatement. Folks are just absolutely taxed, and I totally understand that. I am not as day-to-day. I'm really only in the restaurant like once a week, where my partners are there 7 days a week, but I have other responsibilities in construction and things like that. So we're all in this together. And so, yeah, it's, you know, honestly, my wife, who has a side gig, that used to be her permanent gig, making jewelry, you know, because of raising a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, quite frankly, she seems to have it the hardest out of anyone I know, because of, you know, all these limitations. You don't even think about it till you're in it. You know, the lack of play dates, the lack of music classes or going to the library to read books and all the things that you rely so heavily on. Everyone's just, you know, really struggling.
Right. Phil, I know that some of your neighbors in Corktown have had to make very hard decisions to end businesses. Detroit Institute of Bagels closed just down the street. Does that make you nervous?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's a big part of why folks love Detroit, you know, is the businesses and the things that you have access to of living in a city. And so the business community is plays an important role in that. And so we hope that folks are able to make it. And, you know, and they obviously, these are employers. So part of what makes, you know, living in the city possible is the job market. And so it's, you know, we're just hoping, you know, that we can figure this out sooner than later, because I know there's just tremendous struggle for everybody. I really feel for folks. We closed a business just before the pandemic. And because of that, you know, we were hoping to move somebody else in that, and it's been impossible. So I understand the pain and struggle of it, and hope for the best for everyone.
You know, there's a certain amount of, I guess, what I think of as mobility in the restaurant industry. It's pretty rare to find a place that has been making what it makes for, you know, 20 years or 30 years, not to say that we don't really treasure those businesses that do go the distance. But what is your take on the ability of the restaurant industry, or even just the neighborhood in Corktown, to weather the storm over the long term?
Yeah, I guess it's been adaptability, you know, and I think of some of those businesses that were there before us in Corktown, LJ's Lounge and Nemo's, and you know, there are others, the Lagerhaus. You know, these are places that have been so many different things to so many different people, and as the neighborhood has changed, they too have changed, whether it's like moving from an Irish bar to a rock and roll venue, or moving from a sports bar to in the neighborhood, walking to the stadium, to a sports bar that has transportation, or LJ's, you know, Robert, the owner there, worked the line of GM, and, you know, went from kind of being open sporadically because, you know, the bread and butter was his job with GM, to adapting in so many ways, from comedy nights to karaoke night to just many different things to who they are today. So I think that to be in this game, it's never, you can never rely on being who you were, you know, even 3 years ago. It's always about staying current and with your employees, staying current with the trends and yeah. So I think that's adaptability would be it.
That's key. I want to ask you a question, just as a guy who lives in Detroit, less as a restaurant owner. Do you think the governor should be restricting indoor dining, or is this the right way to let everybody make their own decisions?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm not in her position. And, you know, it's been incredibly hard, this whole process, and the fact that she's had to go through the things she's had to go through, from the threats that have happened. It's just, some people's behavior has been appalling. The idea that her life is threatened over it is just a very sad fact. And so, you know, at this point, after being in the pandemic for this long, it's hard for me to play armchair, you know, governor and tell her what to do. You know, we made the decision based on our reality. And I appreciated the closures as a Detroiter, as a parent. I appreciated the closures in the past. I felt it was necessary. I you know, on a personal level, I feel that we could have maybe got through this quicker had we just done it, been more strict at a certain point. But I'm not a part of the CDC. I'm not privy to the information that they have. And I tend to be maybe naive, maybe Pollyannish, maybe I'm too trusting, but I'm the person that signed up for my vaccine and signed up for the closure, because I'm just hoping to move past this as efficiently and quickly as possible.
Phil Cooley is the founder and owner of Slow's Barbecue in Corktown. Hey, Phil, it's great talking to you. Hang in there.
Thank you so much. Be well and be safe.
In just a moment. Creeping horrors emerging from below in a swarm of billions. I'm sorry. It's so rarely I get to say things like that. Actually, what we're talking about is just cicadas. We'll share details of this spring's hatching after a short break. A lot has changed in Michigan since 2004. In that year, George W. Bush was in the White House. A young lady named Alicia Keys had just made her first record. And some nerdy guy named Mark Zuckerberg had created this thing called Facebook that he said was going to help people stay in touch. I'll tell you what I remember about that year is Brood 10 emerging from the ground to have its way with the human world. Some of us have never been the same since. As you may have heard, the momentous hatching of Brood 10, a collection of cicadas that happens every 17 years, is back. And if you're able to experience it this spring, you'll be treated to one of the most unusual sights that nature has to offer. Billions, that's billions with a B, of cicadas will be hatching simultaneously across the country. And it's going to get loud. With us to explain the phenomenon of Cicada Brood 10 is Howard Russell, an entomologist at Michigan State University. Howard, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April. I am honored to be on your show.
We get cicadas every summer. What is different about Brood 10 than the ones that we usually live with?
Well, the ones we see every summer are 3 to 4 year cicadas, and they're called dog day cicadas, and they don't have the synchronous emergence that make periodical cicadas so spectacular.
So the dog day cicadas, so to speak, they lay their eggs, and then the young cicadas hatch after about 3 or 4 years, and they just kind of come out in a seasonal way. But what can you explain what it is that periodical cicadas like Brood 10 do that's so different?
Periodical cicadas, there are 15 recognized broods, 12 17-year broods, and 3 13-year broods.
And they're called broods because they, for any given brood, they all emerge synchronously at the same time after spending 17 years in the soil feeding on plant roots, primarily tree roots. So when no one really understands the mechanism by which they time themselves after the newly hatched nymphs burrow into the soil, but whatever mechanism it is, it works, and out they come in mass. And as you said, you know, it's not uncommon to see 1.5 million adult cicadas emerge per acre. And they're really large, noisy, lusty insects, and it'll be a spectacle this summer for sure.
I want to get to the lusty part in a minute, but just if for people who've never seen this before, it's really something if you're in a place where periodic cicadas have been burrowed in, to see them start to come out of the ground all at the same time. It's nothing short of eerie. If you're a kind of person who thinks bugs are ooky, you might want to run and hide. But it is truly amazing if you're into it. You mentioned that we don't really know how the cicadas, how they know to do this synchronous thing that they do. But Howard, do we know why periodic cicadas do this? Why they all stay in the ground together and why they all emerge together?
Well, for one reason, I mean, they're a large, tasty insect, and a lot of animals eat them. Birds eat them. Other insects eat them. Moles eat them. So if you emerge all at the same time, and there's millions and billions of you, your chances of being eaten are small if there are millions of others around you. So the term that's kicked around by entomologists, it's called predator saturation, meaning the predators can only eat so much.
This is kind of like if you see a big school of sardines. There's so many of them. Even if a shark or a dolphin goes crazy, there's still like several thousand more sardines that are going to make it to reproduce the next year.
That's correct. And so that's what we're seeing with this. And why a 17-year life cycle? I have not seen any good reason for why it takes so long, because as we've talked about, the dog day cicada, which is actually a bigger cicada, is able to complete its development in 3 to 4 years and emerge as adults and carry on. And why the periodical cicadas emerge after 13 or 17 years, I don't know. It could be out of respect for their tree hosts, I guess. But I really don't know.
Do we know much about how Brood 10 survives this length of hibernation? You mentioned that what they're living on is tree roots, but are there any other special adaptations that you know of that allow them to stay in the ground that long?
Well, I don't think they hibernate in terms of being inactive. I think they actively, as long as temperatures permit, actively feed on the tree roots. And then, of course, they have an exoskeleton that keeps them protected to some degree from water loss. And then other adaptations, I mean, their front legs are modified to assist in digging and moving through the soil. And they have a piercing needle-like mouth part that they insert into tree roots. And then they can withdraw sap and sustain themselves and complete their development. So...
Or suck the blood of humans, Howard. You're freaking me out here. They don't actually drink human blood, though, right?
as far as I know, I haven't run across that. In fact, they're pretty harmless to people. I mean, if you grab one, they will buzz and vibrate in an attempt to get away from you. But generally, they don't bite or anything like that. So you can handle them without worry.
What do you remember about the last emergence of Brood 10?
The last time, well, I was actually busy doing other things. I did not actually go down to Ann Arbor and witness them, but I do remember there was a golf tournament on that weekend, or a weekend right during peak emergence, and you could barely hear the announcers call the golf match or describe the golf match or a shot because the cicadas were just buzzing and it was pretty loud, and that you could see them flying on the golfers. You could see them on the crowd, in the crowd. It was pretty interesting.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Howard Russell. He's an entomologist at Michigan State University, and he's filling us in on the emergence of the Brood 10 cicada swarm this year. If a person has never seen this phenomenon before and wants to experience it, how do you recommend people find out where they might be lying in waiting to hatch?
Well, this year my wife and I are going to go down to the Cherry Hill Nature Preserve east of Ann Arbor. I think that's, from what I understand, is a periodical brood 10 cicada hotspot.
And can you tell us a little bit more about how the emergence begins or how you can tell when it's close?
Well, just by date. I mean, we would expect emergence to begin in mid-May, depending on temperature. Soil temps at 8 inches, they're, at least from what I understand, they begin to emerge in mass when the soil temp at 8 inches reaches about 64 degrees Fahrenheit. Mm-hmm. And prior to that, the nymphs sort of tunnel up near to the surface and wait there until it's time to emerge in mass. And then out they come, generally at night. They find a vertical surface. They climb up. They split down the back. Their exoskeleton splits down the back, and out emerges the adult cicadid, which is white at that point. And we refer to those as tenerals. The exoskeleton hasn't hardened down yet. And then these tenerals, once they're formed enough to crawl up into the trees, they crawl up into the trees, and they can continue their maturation process for 6 to 10 days or so. And then once they've completed and their body is hardened, the males then begin to sing to attract females. They mate. Eggs are laid in small branches that the female slices open, and she'll lay 2 to a dozen eggs in a single slit on a branch, and probably anywhere from 400 to 600 eggs per female. And then once she's completed egg laying, she dies. About 6 weeks, 5 to 6 weeks later, the eggs hatch and the nymphs fall to the ground. They burrow in, or they tunnel in, and begin to feed on plant roots. And some may feed on grass roots, depending on what's around. But eventually, they end up on tree roots, and that's where they complete their development, or that's where they spend the next 17 years feeding on tree sap.
The whole glorious cycle begins again.
Right. So, I mean, in terms of, you know, what we consider, you know, a full and enriching life, it doesn't seem like much. But to a cicada, that's what they do, right?
It's their thing, yeah. Which parts of Michigan are most affected by Brood X, this really large swarm that's going to emerge? You mentioned Ann Arbor. Are there other places where we can expect to see them?
Well, that's interesting. If you and I've been trying to track that down, and there's some disagreement. Sort of the standard is the U.S. Forest Service map for brood, periodical cicada brood emergence. And they show Jackson County. They don't really show Washtenaw County. For some reason, somebody really made an error there. It appears that they show Jackson rather than Washtenaw County. But some of the work done by Thomas Moore, actually at the University of Michigan, had a historical record where Brood 10 showed up, and it was actually in as far north as Genesee County in 1936. It was in Lenawee County in 1987. They had collection records there. It was also found in Livingston County in 1987, as well as Oakland County in 1987. I don't have records for 2004. For those locations, but at least they were present, according to Tom Moore, in 1987 in Lenawee, Livingston, Oakland, Washtenaw. Then another site that I looked at had listed Hillsdale County as well.
So those southern tier counties are areas where they have found, where periodical cicadids brood 10 have been found before. But Washtenaw probably is the, from what I understand, the, sort of the epicenter in Michigan for brood 10 cicadas.
Is it possible for periodical cicadas habitats to be destroyed?
All you have to do is take the trees away.
Yeah, seems like a lot can happen in 17 years.
A lot can happen in 17 years, correct. So, you know, developments, and that's probably why the Cherry Hill Nature Preserve outside of Ann Arbor continues to be a good spot to go and witness the spectacle, because these are, you know, it's undisturbed natural area, lots of mature trees. It's perfect for cicadas.
You know, there are scientists I know who study periodic cicadas specifically, and I know how crazy this sounds, but actually follow swarms around in their cars as they hear them emerging in different parts of the Midwest. Is there anything special that we have the opportunity to learn as Brood 10 makes its appearance this year?
It's a tough question, April. I guess what we would learn is, did they return to areas where they were found before?
Right. In other words, are those habitats still the kind of place where a cicada can thrive?
Yeah. Are they intact? Right. So, you know, and these periodical cicadas are unique to Eastern North America. I mean, there's no place else in the world do you find periodical cicadas. I mean, cicadas themselves, you know, just regular cicadas, you know, are found worldwide, but periodical cicadas are unique to the Eastern United States. So, I mean, if you have a chance to witness it, I think it would certainly be worthwhile if you're any kind of bug person at all. But I think what will happen if you live in an area where these things occur, and it'll be kind of interesting for the first week. I'm guessing by week two or three, you'd wish they would go away. And then by week five or six, you know, you're happy that their numbers, that they're dying at that point. Because they can be, you know, I've read where the noise may reach 100 decibels. Well, that's sort of close to a lawnmower or a chainsaw, leaf blower or something like that. That's pretty loud.
It's no joke. I can speak from experience. Do you have any recommendations for people who maybe can't handle the sound? I mean, how do you get away from this? Is it even possible? If you're a place where they do emerge, it seems like they'd just be everywhere.
Well, if you want to stay there, I mean, if you want to stay in this area, there's not much you can do. You can stay indoors. But it's spring, right? And generally springtime in Michigan, people have spent the winter looking forward to being outside. So I guess you could avoid them by staying inside or shopping in areas where there were no trees or whatever. But, you know, if you're in an area where these things emerge, you know, you're going to be thankful that it only happens once every 17 years.
Howard, when you think about younger entomologists, budding entomologists, would you expect that this would be a time when some of them might catch the bug for bugs, so to speak?
Well, it's certainly, you know, very interesting and I don't want to say awe-inspiring, but certainly anybody who's curious and has any kind of interest in entomology would find this to be pretty, pretty interesting.
Well, are there other ways beyond the feast for animals and birds that they provide? Are there other ways that Brood X might affect our environment this year?
I would avoid planting young trees, especially young hardwood trees, in areas where these things persist or are going to emerge, because they can damage small young trees. The females can when they lay their eggs. So you might want to hold off and plant your young trees next fall and avoid damage by cicadas.
Howard Russell is an entomologist at Michigan State University. Howard, it's great talking to you. Thanks for filling us in.
It was great talking to you too, April. Take care.
As we prepare to welcome our insect overlords, we cannot wait to hear your stories about the Brood 10 emergence. Maybe you have some fond memories of the last time this deal went down. That one time when the cicadas filled up the tailpipe of your first car, that Ford Focus you spent so much time trying to keep running, And then the exhaust system was never the same with all those stupid nymphs cramped up in there? Stuff like that. Maybe you have a tasty recipe for this high-protein insect treat that you'd like to share. We understand that cicadas make excellent fish bait, but we're not exactly sure what you catch with them. Do you know? We're here for all of it. Email us. The address is stateside@michiganradio.org. You can leave us comments on the Michigan Radio Facebook page. We do get them. Or tell us all about it on Twitter. Our handle is @statesideradio. After the break, what Michigan's business leaders have to say about proposed election reforms.
You know, they're echoing a lot of concerns that voting rights groups have raised over the strict voter ID provisions, over the absentee ballot drop box restrictions.
And we'll hear from the state's top medical exec about recent COVID developments.
Every shot in an arm is one step closer to having someone be immune and for helping us to fight this pandemic back and this surge that we're seeing right now.
We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The COVID pandemic has been less like one changed set of circumstances and more like a series of constantly changing circumstances for hospitals, decision makers, and really just about everybody in Michigan. Dr. Joan A. Khaldun is Michigan's chief medical executive. Given this week's pause on the use of Johnson & Johnson vaccines and the constant struggle to control Michigan's exploding infection rates, this seemed like a good day to check in. Dr. Khaldun, welcome.
Thank you for having me back.
Between the surge of COVID cases that the state's been dealing with and this pause now on use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, it feels like this is not exactly the best week Michigan has had in the past year. Where does this moment rank for you in terms of the arc of the pandemic?
Well, you know, it certainly is a little bit of a setback, I'll say. I'm certainly concerned that the CDC and FDA are recommending a pause temporarily on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. But, you know, I'm still confident. We still have the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. We've got more than 5.4 million doses in arms, and we will continue to aggressively move forward with our vaccination efforts.
First off, what should people know at this point if they have received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and they have concerns?
Absolutely. So first, let me just say that over 6.8 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine have been administered to date across the United States, 200,000 of those here in Michigan. We are not aware of any of these potential adverse reactions. So this cerebral venous sinus thrombosis and the low platelet counts, we have not heard of any of those responses here in the state of Michigan. So six cases were identified at the national level. They are looking at that data, but it is still very, very rare, six cases out of 6.8 million. Generally, the symptoms occurred within about 6 to 13 days after vaccination. If someone received their vaccine more than 3 or 4 weeks ago, really not something they should be concerned about as far as it being related to this vaccine. That said, anyone who has any concerns, any symptoms, severe headache, abdominal pain, leg pain, difficulty breathing, should certainly contact their doctor about their symptoms.
So the state's vaccine dashboard notes what you just mentioned, that the number of doses administered of Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccines is close to 200,000 people in Michigan. And also, we can see from that dashboard that that's a far lower number than the number of Pfizer and Moderna doses that have made it into arms. Now, understanding that we have to figure that Pfizer and Moderna are a two-dose regime and Johnson & Johnson is a single dose and you're done, I figure it that maybe the ratio is something like 25 to 1. There have been, you know, for every one Johnson & Johnson dose, there've been a lot more administered that were made by the other companies. Does that sound correct to you?
Well, yes, as you said, we do have this data on our dashboard. The bulk of our vaccinations since we started this effort in December have been with the Pfizer vaccine, which was available or authorized first, and then the Moderna vaccine as well. So, yes, the bulk of our vaccination efforts across the state and the country, quite frankly, have been with the Moderna or Pfizer vaccines. Of course, we are disappointed about the pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. We will be awaiting further guidance from the CDC and the FDA in the upcoming days about what they found from those cases, what particular guidance they would give as far as moving forward with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. It is possible that this will still be available for use. So I do think this is a bit of a disappointment today, but these rare side effects, again, they're very rare, 6 cases out of 6.8 million doses. And so I do think that is likely the Johnson & Johnson vaccine will still be part of our vaccines that are available to use. But again, we have to wait and see what the CDC and the FDA tell us.
So again, given the ratio and how much bigger players Pfizer and Moderna are to this point in Michigan's vaccination effort, I mean, is this really a large problem for the state's effort to get everybody vaccinated?
Well, I'm very concerned. Every shot in an arm is one step closer to having someone be immune and for helping us to fight this pandemic back and this surge that we're seeing right now. So, of course, I'm concerned. We want all vaccines in the state. We are ordering all vaccines that are available to us as they become available. And this is a setback. Of course, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, as you said, it's a single dose vaccine. People don't have to come back for a second dose. So for individuals who may be homebound or have more transient living situations, this is certainly an easier vaccine when it comes to administering. But our vaccination efforts will still continue on, and we need to work incredibly hard to get more shots in arms across the state. And I'm pleased with our efforts so far.
Are you worried that this situation with Johnson & Johnson is going to have an adverse effect on the campaign to win over those who were maybe already hesitant about getting vaccinated?
Yes, we're certainly aware that could be the case. But again, it's just really important from a public health standpoint. As a doctor, we just make sure people have the information that they need about these vaccines. There's a very robust national monitoring program in place. 6 out of 6.8 million doses, they actually found that out. They're identifying what the problem may be. They will be giving us more guidance when it comes to what patients and providers should know about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So we will continue to be transparent. We will make sure we are sharing all the data about all 3 vaccines with everyone so that they can still make a choice. And hopefully that choice is still to get vaccinated. That is the way we are going to end this pandemic as quickly as possible and help us get out of this surge.
We've talked to a couple of epidemiologists over the past couple of weeks who agree with the CDC that the state should have firmer restrictions, a return to some kind of complete shutdown for a few weeks to allow the vaccine to catch up with the spread of the variant. I want to play something for you that Deborah Furr Holden told us. She's a professor of public health at MSU Flint campus, and she's also director of the Flint Center for Health Equity. And here's what she had to say to us on Monday.
This is the time for us to tighten up because we do have good quality vaccines who would be a game changer. The vaccines would be a game changer, but only if we're able to stop spread.
Dr. Khaldun, what's your reaction to that recommendation?
So I absolutely admire Dr. Furr Holden. She's one of my friends. So I certainly appreciate that. You know, I think that there are multiple tools in our toolbox right now. Michigan knows how to bring this surge down. I'm in regular communications with the governor, with Director Hertel about policies that would be impactful when it comes to this surge. Vaccines are an important part of bringing the surge down. But again, as the governor and I mentioned in our press conference last week, if we could stop all the gathering, limit our indoor dining in restaurants, we can pause on the youth sports. Those are the things that I think would help contribute to us bringing that curve down. And I continue to be in regular conversations with the governor and the director about that.
Right. A story emerged last week that a small handful of people who were fully vaccinated in Michigan still contracted COVID-19. This wasn't a surprise. You know, we know that vaccines aren't a suit of armor that completely protects against all forms of illness. There were a couple of hundred people who were hospitalized because of COVID, and there were a couple of folks who died. The headlines may not have provided the full context for comorbidities and other things that were going on in these cases, but they arguably did some damage to public's concerns about this. Do you think there's room in the public dialogue between the administration and Michiganders about risk assessment and taking a look at what is really going to be best for everyone's public health as people think about getting vaccinated?
Absolutely. I mean, we are all in this together. These vaccines are 95% effective. That means that there are going to be some people that do get COVID after they've been vaccinated. So that is not a failure per se. That is something that is expected based on what we saw in the clinical trials. The data that we're seeing, it still shows that a positive case of COVID-19 after vaccination is still quite rare. And so these vaccines are still effective in preventing COVID-19. But absolutely, I think it's important we all think about each other. That's why we still say after you've been fully vaccinated, it's best practice to wear your mask, wash your hands, as our numbers are surging like they are in the state, of avoiding large gatherings. All of those things are really, really important. And people do need to understand it's not just you. It's about your family members. It's about your neighbor. It's about people they may live with who may be more susceptible to getting severe disease and unfortunately losing their life to COVID-19.
I'm hearing the message that you're optimistic that people will make the right choices about continuing to mask up even after they've been vaccinated. That's in line with the administration's overall message of optimism. At the same time, Michigan has this standing right now as a national hotspot. Is there reason or evidence that can help us feel that optimism in this moment?
You know, I will say there is some optimism. Again, our 5.4 million doses of the vaccines in arms, and quite frankly, the fact that we've got more than two-thirds of Michiganders over the age of 65 who have had at least one dose of the vaccine, and that is why they are not being hospitalized at nearly the rates we're seeing of the younger population who became eligible for the vaccines later on. So vaccines work. We are getting vaccines in arms. I know Johnson & Johnson, a little bit of a setback, but we still have Pfizer and Moderna coming into the state. We are asking for additional vaccines in the state as well, moving vaccines to where there is higher numbers of outbreaks across the state. So I think that there is a reason to be optimistic. We will get through this. This is a very difficult time, but this will end. If we all do our part, we will be able to keep our hospitalizations lower. We will be able to get through this surge. So I am optimistic.
Dr. Jonae Khaldun is Michigan's chief medical executive. Dr. Khaldun, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've talked quite a bit on the show in recent weeks about the controversial package of election bills moving through Michigan's state legislature. These measures include a lot of things: restricted hours on absentee voting boxes, photo ID requirements, and changes that could further politicize our boards of canvassers. The chair of the Michigan Republican Party says the GOP intends on pushing the measures into law, even if they get vetoed by Governor Whitmer. Critics say that the whole thing is part of a national effort by GOP leaders to limit voter access and suppress turnout in urban areas that vote Democratic. Now the business community in Michigan has come out against this package of bills, including some big names like Ford, GM, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and Quicken Loans. With us to talk more about the GOP proposals is Jonathan Osting, political reporter for Bridge, Michigan. Hey, Jonathan, welcome back to Stateside.
Hey, April. Thanks for having me.
Let's start out with the standard legislative procedure through which bills usually become laws. Where does this package of election bills stand right now?
Well, it's in the very early stages. These bills have been introduced, but not yet even taken up in committee. So typically, they'll first be debated in the Senate Elections Committee. Then if they were approved there, they'd go to the Senate, onto the House, before reaching the governor's desk. So debate hasn't even begun yet. And Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky has said that at least on some of the bills, there could be opportunities to negotiate still.
Like I said a few minutes ago, Governor Whitmer is expected to veto most, if not all, of these new bills if they pass. And the Republican Party co-chair, Ron Weiser, with the state party, says that if that happens, the party intends to raise money for a petition campaign. If they do that and they get enough signatures, the legislature could pass the bills in a procedure that could not be overturned by the governor. Do you know if that's moved past the talking stage, if any groundwork is being laid for a petition campaign?
You know, they haven't started a committee, which would be required to start raising money for that sort of effort or spending on that sort of effort. So, no, it sounds like, you know, Ron Weiser has been discussing this idea with various GOP groups, but that there is no, you know, formal mechanism or entity that's been set up to start actually planning for this. That said, that would probably happen anyways after, you know, Republicans see what they are able to get through the legislature. I mean, ostensibly, Governor Whitmer is not going to veto every one of these bills if they're not tie-barred together. For instance, Senate Republicans like to point out that they would their package would require clerks to open for one day of early voting on the second Saturday before an election. So there are some things that I'm sure Democrats are going to agree with in this package, but there's a lot they're going to object to as well. So we don't know what it'll look like at the finish line yet.
So let's get to today's news that some pretty big players in Michigan's business community have made a statement that they're not in favor of most of the things in this package. Can you give us the briefing of what they said?
Yeah, they didn't really get into specifics, so they didn't single out any bills that they have objections to. But generally, they laid out a list of principles, including equitable access for all voters. And, you know, some of the lines that really stood out to me was, you know, they said, for instance, government must avoid actions that reduce participation in elections, particularly among historically disenfranchised communities, persons with disabilities, older adults, racial minorities, and low-income voters. Now, they didn't specify what that comment was about, but, you know, they're echoing a lot of concerns that voting rights groups have raised over the strict voter ID provisions, over the absentee ballot Dropbox restrictions, and over simple things like barring election officials from mailing out absentee ballots to everyone or providing free return postage on absentee ballots. So, yeah, they kept it pretty vague here. But it's notable that they spoke out at all at this early stage. We certainly saw a lot of pushback in Georgia and some companies that spoke out against laws there. But they did so mostly after the bills were passed, which, you know, probably didn't have a very big impact. Also of note, not on this particular letter, but on another national letter, Dow Chemical, based in Midland, another big Michigan employer, has spoken out against the Georgia law and any proposals to make voting harder. So there seems to be some momentum building amongst the corporate community here in Michigan and nationally as well to speak out.
Jonathan, do you read anything into that letter from the 37 signatures that they mean to take further action if the bills go any farther?
Well, certainly I'll be watching whether they weigh in committee testimony, for instance, when these bills do go through the legislative process. What specifically do they object to? And I mean, it's worth asking, you know, none of them responded to our requests to answer this question, but will they potentially withhold corporate, you know, political contributions to lawmakers that support this legislation? That probably would, you know, be a lever that they could pull if they really wanted to try and stop this from happening, going beyond simply issuing a statement.
Jonathan Oesting reports on politics for Bridge, Michigan. Hey, Jonathan, thanks for checking in, and thanks for the coverage.
Thank you for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Newham, Nell Ovett, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you at this time tomorrow.